It's my pleasure to introduce Lynn Messner. She's got a wonderful story. I'm really glad that you get to hear it today. So with that, I'll give you Lynn Messner.
Hi, everybody. My name is Lynn Messner, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Diane and the committee, for asking me to do this. Some of y'all might relate that it's always an honor to be asked. Not always great to do it, but an honor to be asked. I would say it's not one of my favorite things to do in AA, but I'm glad to be a part of this, and thank you. It's an honor. It's an honor. Yeah, and it's so nice to see such dear friends out there, no throwing tomatoes. These three guys right here in the front were the first three men I think I ever met in AA. I feel like they knew me when I was a kid. That's what I felt like. And they're not that much older than I am. But it's nice to see y'all in the front. I did talk to my sponsor in the car in the parking lot, and I was reminded of a couple of things. First, I can remember the first time I ever told my story, and I told her, I went, oh, I have such a boring story. Wish it was more exciting. And she said, Lynn, only an alcoholic would want a more exciting story. And the other thing I thought about on my way over here is, you know, it just gives us directions about sharing what you were like, what happened, and what you're like today. It's very simple. And I had this little example coming over here. I put into GPS the best way to get here. I hadn't been here in a while, and there's several ways to come from my house. And so the GPS told me where to have come here. And I looked at it and went, well, I think I know a better way. And it just reminded me a little bit about my personality. You know, man, that's what you've learned in AA. Just follow the directions. And I got here pretty darn quick without much traffic. So I'm going to just tell you a little bit about myself, what I was like. I'll give you some basics. I don't know if you ever do this when you're hearing a speaker, like wondering about things. You know, well, I'm 70 years old. I turned 70 in March. And I also celebrated my 43rd birthday in March. So, March 24th, 1982, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Been married to George Messner for 35 years. We met in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am a native. I was born in Atlanta. My parents are from Atlanta. I was the baby. I had two older brothers. My parents have passed away. My brothers have passed away. I'm the only remaining one in my immediate family. But I grew up, like I said, I was born in Atlanta, but my family moved quite a bit when I was young. My dad joined the Peace Corps when I was 7 years old, so we lived in South America for 3 years. Then we moved back to Atlanta, and we moved into a different home, so I went to a different school. So really, I went to a number of schools before I was 12 years old. I like to call it the new kid syndrome. I sort of identify this with connected to my personality because if any of y'all had that experience being a new kid, I always felt like I needed to be on my best behavior. You know, I wanted to be liked and a part of, and so I was always paying attention to what others were doing and how I needed to fit in and that kind of thing. And so that really is kind of a part of my personality, and I can't say that at 70 years old it has gone away completely. When we moved back to Atlanta in our second home, I went to my first school for 2 years in a row, and I was 12 years old, and then my family moved to Florida. My dad was then worked at a college in Deland, Florida. If anybody steps in Hatters, yay, that is the first I've ever had that. Wow, that's top after. So I lived 6 years in a little college town, Deland, Florida, and that really helped a lot from my new kid moving and feeling like I'd always having to readjust and all of that kind of thing. And so I had a group of friends that were kind of solid, and I'm friends with today. But what I'll tell you that I learned in AA that looking back is I still always felt like that new kid, kind of what some describe as, you know, the outsider looking in and making sure you need to do, you know, but not really feeling a part of. And if you looked at me in high school, you would never know that. I always felt like I needed to be a part of things. I joined a lot of clubs, and I was very active. And so from the outside, I looked like I was a part of, and I looked kind of like a little bit of a goody-two-shoes. Ha, ha, ha. I looked like a sweet Southern Baptist girl that I grew up. But, you know, I went back to a high school reunion. I think it was my 10-year reunion, and the guy said to me, "You know, Lynn, I always knew you were a closet derelict." And I thought, you know what, that really does describe me, because I had like that thing of wanting to be the good girl, kind of have a good reputation, but if you only knew, and I like to kind of test the waters over here, but I didn't want you to really know that. I'm going to tell you about my first drink, and I will tell you a little bit about my last drink. My first drink was my first drunk, was my first blackout, was my first pass out, was my first throwing up, and it all happened on a blind date. I would say you won't be surprised, it was my only date with that guy. It wasn't exactly a blind date. My brothers were older, so they were already in college in this college town. And I sort of knew this guy a little bit, but never been out with him. Double date, and I'm going to tell you a little detail about it because for me it's important. You know, there's a lot of reasons that we go to meetings, you know, one of my big reasons is I never want to forget where I came from, you know, and how it all started and how I still relate to that, even though it was a long time ago. But we double dated. I've never had a drink that I ever knew. And these were two college guys, and they picked us up. My girlfriend and I picked us up. We went to another of his friend's house, and they fixed these drinks. And they were mixed drinks, so they weren't too bad tasting. I really can't remember what it was. It could have been a screwdriver or something mixed that I could really drink and keep it down. And then the land where we lived was just a few miles from Daytona Beach. And this guy had his pilot's license, and he said, "We got a treat for you." He had rented a plane, and we went, and on the way to the Daytona Airport, we had a couple other of these mixed drinks, and then we got on the plane. And we flew all over Daytona Beach, the ocean, and I got off that plane, and I thought, "Whew, I'm really feeling something from that airplane ride." We went to a bar in Daytona Beach, and the way I remember it is we had fake IDs. I'm not really sure how that worked. I was 17, but and this is the part that's important for me because I later learned what this really meant as an alcoholic and having the mind of an alcoholic that I think is different than others. And that is, beginning of the date, very nervous. What am I going to wear? How does my hair look? What about my makeup? Very, very nervous going out with this college guy. We went into this bar, and they brought us drinks on a flame. And they're big red drinks. I don't even remember what they are called. We sat, and I sipped on that, and I really do remember this clearly. And I went from being that nervous 17-year-old to looking at him and going, "Aren't you lucky to be with me?" That is stuck in my head. He was so lucky to be with me. He had to carry me to the car, carry me in the house, stop on the way back from Daytona to DeLand, and I fell in a ditch, throwing up. So that's how lucky he was. I blacked out. I do not remember anything, you know, leaving the bar, but the weird thing is I remember the next day I had my first hangover, you know, that heavy-headed, dry mouth. And I really did out loud say, "Gosh, I'm not going to do that again." It felt horrible physically. But when I heard a speaker say, when I got sober, about we have that mental thing in our head that it leaves something, and I remember that I got prettier and more comfortable. Something in there said that really wasn't all that bad. I will say I got through high school and I did not drink again. I did test the waters in other areas a little bit just to be cool, but I didn't drink again until college. My first drink was at 17 and my last drink was at 27, so that's 10 years of drinking. And I do many times wonder, wow, how did that happen so fast, you know, and how did I gratefully get ready to be sober and have a different life so quickly? And I don't have a lot of answers for that. I feel like I progressed in my own drinking pretty quickly and grateful for it, that I hit a bottom, that I didn't want to live that way anymore. But I did have stages that it looked at if you were kind of doing snapshots. I did finish college. I did notice that once I started going to fraternity parties and keg parties, I really liked beer. I continued to like beer until my first AA meeting, which I'll tell you, I took a beer there too. But I just liked beer somehow, and I liked it when my brothers would say, God, my sister can drink me under the table. I thought that was, you know, a big deal. I could see that in college that I always, you know, when you had parties on the weekend, I'd want to start on Thursday and then keep going, you know, Sunday night. I could tell that. It didn't interfere in my life at that point. I was drinking more and more, but I did finish college. At that time, my dad changed jobs and said, why don't you move back to Atlanta, finish school in Atlanta. And I thought at the time that I don't really want to change schools, but he said, if you're not happy, you can come back to Stetson. And I said, okay. Well, I lived at home with my mom and dad until I got sober. After I got sober. Poor mom and dad. So I lived with them, and I had the same experience. I was in college. I did finish college, but drinking became much more a part of every day, you know, not just keg parties and so forth. But again, I looked like I was still sort of managing things. But what started happening is every time I drank, I got drunk. And not every time did I black out or get sick. I could still look like I maintained some. But it was you could tell by the way I drank and how often I drank. I mean, even then, before I even finished college, my mother would say to me, do you realize that you have a beer in your hand all the time? Do you know why? And I said, I like beer. What other reason? I just did it. I did not know. Boy, when I read that in our literature, we love the effect of it. I didn't know that was my answer to her at that time. But I did finish college, and I got a job. And I always think, I got the perfect job for an alcoholic. I got a job traveling, you know, where you, back in the, I love that when I say back in the day, but you know, I had to pay before cell phones and pagers, and we had answering machines and so forth, but, so I got a job traveling, and so pretty much would be gone like Monday through Friday, flew, drove, whatever, but I didn't have a boss looking, you know, I had a lot of freedom. And I had this gal, I swear to this day, that I think she had to be alcoholic. She trained me in my job, but she trained me how to drink. Now, I'm going to tell you, this sounds really kind of kooky, but this another stage of drinking was that I went from putting beer, like, in a little ice, you know, and then I do it in the sink, ice down, and then I start doing it in the bathtub. You know, putting the beer in the bathtub, you know. I mean, it didn't feel really then. This was from 77 to 82. It was very short, wasn't it? Wow. I had the job drinking, and this is when it started interfering in my life. I was on the road, very, very, very fortunate. I didn't have bad things happen to me. But I did start waking up in strange places and maybe with strange people. Wondering what I was doing there. It didn't happen all the time, but it did start happening. And I got a little scared every once in a while. But as a lot of us maybe would say, I'll just be more careful and drink a little less and just be careful. I lost that job in 1980. And this took another little turn, what I would say, in my drinking, because I was living with my mom and dad, and then I started looking like maybe some of us others did. If you ever had the stage in your life where you were drinking, but you were trying to look like you weren't drinking, and that you looked kind of responsible. Like, I was living at home, they knew I was looking for a job, my parents were working, I would be drinking, and then I would try to look like I had been doing something productive by the time they got home, and also not smelling like alcohol. And so, we kind of use this expression at my house now, but I used to call them, I didn't pass out, I would just have little nappy poos, you know? And so I would have these little nappy poos to get feeling better before they came in, you know? It was not easy to do. So this went on for a few months, and miraculously, through my lack of, not because of my productivity, but I found another job. And again, this is probably the beginning of the end, is I got a job that was outside Atlanta, and I thought this was good. You know, I loved it when I heard somebody say the geographic cure, you know, like we really made these geographic changes, and I really did think, okay, left Atlanta, I had a boyfriend at the time, and I thought, oh, I needed just a new start on everything. And I'm sorry, but Columbia, South Carolina is my spot, I'm sure. But this will just tells the tale, the beginning of the end, is that I moved there in June of 1981, and in September, I was not leaving my apartment. I was drinking around the clock. Every once in a while, I try to go do my job, but basically drinking more than I was leaving and more than I was working. Again, you're not as easy to track down if you don't have cell phones and things. Now, this is another little weird thing. I thought this was really strange, so I heard someone else say it in a meeting. Is I wanted to disconnect from the outside world, and I didn't know what was going to happen. I just was drinking. You know, I started drinking in the morning, thinking I'd somehow get myself together to be able to go work or do something. So I really don't know why. I just needed to disconnect for a while. I took my answering machine and my phone and put them in a drawer. So I wouldn't hear it, wouldn't see it. Very strange, but I thought, I do. But then I heard somebody in a meeting, it's rare that you've done something that somebody else hasn't done, you know? Always makes you feel good. And I started drinking in the morning. I couldn't, you know, the cycle started. And I say this, my brother Tim, we were 15 months apart. We were always very close. He used to hate it when I tell this story because he's like, oh, Lynn, don't. But after a while, people do look for you, like your boss, your parent, your family. She's not answering, you know, what's going on. And they call the office of the apartments, and then that office sent a policeman to my door and said, are you okay? I went, oh, yeah. And they said, call home. I went, oh, okay. And I called my brother, Tim, and he worked for Delta. Called him at work. I said, Tim, this is Lynn. I think I need help. And I hung up, as I remember it, passed out, came to, he was staying in my apartment. He just hung up the phone, took a flight, got there, and I guess I'd left the door open from the policeman. But so he said to me, we're worried about you. But you know what he did great? He'd never gone to Al-Anon, knew nothing about alcoholism. He did not ask any questions. He did not interrogate me. He said, why don't you just come home for a little bit? And we drove home kind of quiet. Took my car to Atlanta. And I don't remember what my family said to me exactly. My mother was the one that asked the most questions, you know. But if y'all relate to this, I didn't know how to answer the questions. I didn't know why I was drinking or what was wrong with me. I didn't grow up in a family of alcoholism. I always laugh because they came out after I got sober, though. Those alcoholics in my family start popping up. So I came back to Atlanta. And surprisingly, I lost that job, you know, when you don't work. Usually, but So I lost my job, and look at here, the same cycle. You know how we say the cycle happens all over again? Back at home, back drinking, looking for a job, and one day my mother said, why don't you go to a meeting with me tonight? We had never talked to Alcoholics Anonymous, never talked, none of that. And I said, you mean AA, don't you? And she'd been going to Al-Anon, and I didn't know it. And so, this is funny too, I remember this so clearly, because years later I go, I was quoting the Big Book and didn't know it. Because I said, no. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic, and I will not be one. And you know, y'all know that part in the literature? Once an alcoholic. And she said, well, just go to one meeting with me. 6 months before I got sober, I did go to a meeting. I don't know where. We laughed about this, too. Mom took me to Dunwoody because she thought there'd be nicer alcoholics than Dunwoody. Now, I'm going to jump forward real quick because this is the same mom who went to several AA meetings with me. And y'all remember the little house, and we had, back then it wasn't as cool, bikers. I mean, we had all kinds of people, right, at that little house in Clarkson. And so, and she loved it. She just thought it was amazing. So she didn't care. She was just glad her daughter was getting sober. But we did laugh about it. So I cannot tell you anything about that meeting. I think they talked about anonymity. I was very glad. Didn't want anybody to know me. But what was, and this is why I used to think, oh, when it's a new person in the meeting, you know, let's say the right things. Let's, you know, make sure we didn't. And what I remember is that somebody gave me a white chip, and somebody gave me a pamphlet. Don't know what it said, but I do know that it had central office number on the back of it. I kept that in my purse. That was in September, and I called central office 6 months later, but it was in my purse. And so I think, you know, it just doesn't matter what we say. When you're ready or you hear something you need to hear, you have the experience, what happened? Same thing. I was living at home and started drinking around the clock again. My brother Tim got married, and he went on his honeymoon, and I don't know why I thought I needed to be in his apartment and take care of things. He didn't have a plant or an animal or anything to take care of. I just needed to stay in his apartment and watch out. And my brother was not an alcoholic, so he was, I was like a kid in the candy store, because I used to be the kind of alcoholic, you go buy a bottle and you drink it, or you buy beer and you drink it, you know, every day. I didn't buy and, you know, have a bar set up, but my brother Tim did. He had a cabinet full. I started drinking. Same thing happened. Wasn't answering the phone. They couldn't get a hold of me, and this was pretty impactful for me. And my dad came to see about me, and he said, you've been drinking. And I said, no shit. I never trusted my dad. He came in, and I think about this a lot, just for parents that had to see their, you know, just about 27 years old, and I had done nothing but smoke cigarettes and drink, didn't shower, didn't eat for I don't know how many days, and then you see your daughter like that. So years later, I thought about that, and I went, that could not have been good. It was difficult for him. But then he came in and he sat down, and I don't remember a lot, but I do remember this. You know, it doesn't have to be an alcoholic who says the message to you that sticks. He asked me about my drinking again. He's, you know, you're drinking a lot. And I said, yeah. And then all of a sudden I said, I just can't be an alcoholic. The stigma to the family. I literally said that to him. And I can imagine what I look like. They talk about the stigma. But you know what he said to me? And I don't know why I remembered it, because I was pretty drunk. And I remembered it then, I remember it today, and it always helps me. And he said, Lynn, being an alcoholic is not the problem. Not doing anything about it is the problem. And that just stuck. I said, I'll be home tomorrow. And so, of course, I start, you know, I only drank in the morning for medicinal reasons, right? You know, when I have a shake, it's real terrible. And just a real quick thing is, I didn't know why I drank. I didn't know it was for the effect. But I also, towards the end, from, you know, obviously the stage of going from social drinking to drinking alone to drinking in the morning, it became from, you know, the feeling of, ooh, this feels good, to the necessity, right? And then feeling that, but I didn't know why. It just seemed like, why can't I just do life? Like, what is wrong with me that I can't just do life, you know? Date, keep a relationship, work, show up for, I mean, I just thought, I just didn't know. The next day, did go home. Now, by this time, my smart mother wasn't ooey-gooey, warm and fuzzy. You know what I mean? Like, she wasn't saying, like, you want to go to a meeting? She was, you do what you need to do. And I called central office, talked to Helen. Don't you wonder how many people called central office, talked to Helen, and Helen said, where do you live? And I'm in Clarkston. She gave me the address of Clarkston. This was my last drink, is that I went to where I thought Clarkston was, but I didn't know it was in the church or this little house. And so I went to the little magic market, got a tall beer, because I had the shakes and the hangover, and I was nervous. Guzzled half the beer, put it in my car. You know, sometimes I could get a little weepy thinking about this, because it's, to me, the power of who and what we are. But I put that beer down, and I never picked it up. I think I even had somebody else pour it out for me. And all I did was, when I walked in the door of that meeting, and it happened to be a Wednesday night, Clarkston women's meeting, and when I walked in the door, my last thought was, they told me it was only an hour, the beer will still be cold. And that was the last drink I had. You know, so there's so many things to me that I don't know why we all might have different experiences of getting sober, staying sober, what happens to us. That was mine. And I always look at it. Sometimes I think, was it magic in that room? But I also have to tell you that I truly believe several things. But I believe it was a power greater than myself that I was willing to walk in the door. And for me, saying, my name is Lynn and I'm an alcoholic, at the very end when everybody's staring at you, and they gave me a chip again. But there are women in that room, Dee Dee and Barbara A., I know some of y'all remember these people, were kind and loving and accepting. And I said, I really would like to talk to whoever's in charge after the meeting. I really said that. And Barbara A. looked at me and she said, sweetie, she says, we just help each other. And I was, okay. I didn't pick up the drink. Now, I didn't mean I didn't want to drink or have the thought of drinking, but something was removed. And I look at it like a higher power, the magic of AA, one alcoholic sharing with another, because I don't remember a lot, but I remember a couple things that women said that I went, ooh, I think they understand. And what I started doing, this isn't profound, because like everybody else, I learned what to do to stay sober from other alcoholics. And one of the things they said is to get a sponsor. I found a sponsor very quickly, Gwen. She's still my sponsor today. Great relationship, so grateful for her, and she looked like she was in charge. She was at Clarkston, she was making coffee, she was caring to me, she was talking to people, she sponsored 50 women, and I just was like one of those little ducklings falling around. We laughed about this, but I chose her because she was tall, single, and Soul Cosmetics. I was tall, single, and Soul Cosmetics. We had so much in common. But I guess we give God credit for that one, too, because it just was meant to be. So I will tell you what I did at the beginning, still do today, and that is, she said, Lynn, go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I went, whoa, don't you know I have a job? I wasn't doing it well, but I sort of had a job. And don't drink. Just today. And I remember the person, when I left the meeting, just don't drink tonight and come back tomorrow. And I think that's so profound. Don't drink tonight and come back tomorrow. And if we all did that, we would just stay sober, right? And in between, I just followed what she suggested. You know, she had a great sponsor. Gay Garner was her sponsor. So I followed in those footsteps. You work the steps. I did inventory kind of quickly. And I really believe this, and she says it today, stay close. You know, you stay close to God, to the women in your life, to meetings. Stay close, because that covers a big umbrella, doesn't it? And I feel like I still do that today. I'll go a day without talking to a few alcoholics. And I feel like my connection, somebody was saying this last night, Clarkson just celebrated 50 years, which is really cool. We celebrated last night, and somebody was saying this, who knew, you know, having just a wealth of people in your life, and especially the women. She just took me around. We went to a lot of different meetings, and I just followed her around, you know, and did kind of what she did until I could kind of stand on my own a little bit. We laughed about this in the car. I said, but I also remember you saying, because I always said she was very gentle, when I'd say, oh, I don't know if I want to do that, can do that. And she'd say, well, I didn't ask you if you wanted to. Ask you to do it. But for me, that's how Alcoholics Anonymous was. You know, somebody suggesting it, and you knew it came from their heart. They knew, you just knew it came from their heart, and that she wanted me to be sober and have a good life. And I will tell you, I have had a good life. I have totally grown up in Alcoholics Anonymous. I may have been 27 years old, but I felt about 12. And I had to learn how to show up and suit up. Oh, my God, at 6 months, I lost that job. And I thought, who gets sober and loses jobs? What is that? It was so humiliating. And a guy in AA gave me a job, one that I could had to clock in and clock out. So I had to show up. And then soon after that, some of y'all probably know Mike Trainer. Did y'all know Mike Trainer? He gave me a job and back in sales, you know, and I could start inching my way back into a career. And he was great. He was a good AA boss. He really was. It was a great experience. So then I had to learn how to pay bills on time. Like you get a bill, you pay a bill. You know what I used to do? And Gwen used to laugh about this, but I used to have a drawer, and I'd put them all in the drawer, and then close it up. Just like I used to do with the telephone and the answering machine. Don't see it. And I think that she says, Lynn, I'm going to stay on the phone until you open that drawer and pull out all the bills. And you just put them on your counter there. So it's funny. Like it's kind of a joke, and like I had to grow up step by step. And then show up, suit up, show up, pay bills, make amends. I was so, so grateful that I could make amends to my family, my brother Tim. My brother Ted was up in Connecticut, so he didn't get to see his little sister go down too much. But I was also very glad that I could also make amends to my parents and be with them in their illness and when they passed. And we were talking about it. My parents loved AA. They'd come to all the birthdays. And then they'd start meeting people, and they'd come to their birthdays. And then they went to the roundup for years. I think the first 5 years, they thought, these speakers are so entertaining. Oh, my God. They might not relate to the drinking part, but they just love the stories. One of their favorite was Clancy. Love Clancy. Oh, yes, they just couldn't wait to talk to him. But it was kind of sharing AA, you know, in a good way. And then it was dating. Is anybody else single and sober in AA? So that was like a little kid also, again. Kissed a few frogs before I found my parents. And those guys would probably say I was the frog. But I had to get my heart broken a little bit. But I really did kind of learn how to date, you know, like learn, get to know people and socialize. And at Clarkston back then, we used to date in a group, you know what I mean? Like men and women, boys and girls, I'd say we'd go out. And in that group was this guy named George. And so, and he was very good friends with my friend and his wife. I was friends with his wife. So we went out in a group and I remember, I have to tell this story. He gets so tired of it, but I have to tell it. I was at George's first meeting. I had 4 more years in George. I don't work in much, but I was at George's first meeting, and when he came in, my word for him was pitiful. He had a beard. His face was red. He was on crutches. Mike, you remember, right? He was like this. You had to look at it. And I know this is repeated, but I always think about it, and I always say, and if somebody had said, and that's the man you're going to spend the rest of your life with, I would have gone, hey! But George got sober. He got off his crutches and started working, and so our first date was his first year sober, after his first year. And George will tell you, it was like platonic dating, if you know what I mean. And he got bored. And I liked it. And so we kind of went apart, and I went back to the old boyfriend, and he started dating this girl from Clarkston, and he started looking better. We show up with that girl, and I go, what's he doing with her? Broke up with the boy, that probably needed to be finished. And then I was just sitting watching him date this other girl. And so, I won't go into this story. It's a neat story that, about an old friend of his that came to visit, and we all went out to dinner, and she said to him, well, tell me about this Lynn Banks person. He's, oh, I told you, we dated. You know, she said, you should call her back up. I think she's got feelings for you. He did. And you know, I have to say this funny story because it's about my mother, but I told Mom, because she loved George. She loved George. And she, that first time around, round one, and she said, I said, Mom, George called me up and wanted to have coffee. Oh, it was in November. Oh, I bet he's getting engaged to that girl. I said, thanks a lot, Mom. But he called me up, and we went and talked and been together ever since. Yeah, it was good. It was good. We dated, and it was really nice dating, getting to know somebody, sharing Alcoholics Anonymous like we did. He had a sponsor. I had a sponsor. We had an AA wedding. My sponsor was my maid of honor. His best man was his, you know, it was really, really special. And it's been special for 35 years, George. I'll just say that. And I say that because it's obviously been a big part of my life, is sharing it with George and sharing Alcoholics Anonymous. And this is the truth. I really do think he has never, ever once said to me, have you called your sponsor? You know, somebody might do. You know, so we share Alcoholics Anonymous, and even though we do it separately. So that's a big part. And then the other thing I want to say real quickly is a home group. I have been a member of Clarkston from the moment I walked in, got my white chip, and it is. And I think that home groups are really important. You know, it was a place that I could be a part of. My sponsor said, service work, however, you know, at Clarkston, we got a lot of things to do to keep it going. And so there's a lot of things to do that you, no matter what, you can do or not do. So that has been a huge part of my recovery, is that I can be a part of a group and a group of people and be of service the best I can. Sponsor women, that has been also one of my greatest gifts. So the growing up in AA has been very important. We were talking about that earlier. And I have to just tell this one story. Sorry, Chet. But when I was sober about maybe 9 months. It was in my first year. And Clarkston used to have late 10 o'clock meetings? On Friday and Saturday nights only. And I showed up at this is really, to me, the example of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think how Bill and Bob started. I showed up when we were in Scottsdale at the mill. Chet was the only one there. We had, and I'll never forget it, he was so patient with me, the newcomer, but we sat across from each other at this long table, and we had a meeting, just the two of us. We read the whole thing, how it works, he used to call me Bonnie Bell. Does anybody remember Bonnie Bell? I worked for Bonnie Bell. You call me Bonnie Bell for months. And he said, Bonnie Bell, we're going to have this meeting. And we did. I can't remember what the topic was, but it was probably just about staying sober. And it was like, that's what AA is. One alcoholic talking to another, even if there's just two of you. We made coffee, we had a meeting, and I thought, that was the example for me. I will tell you today, I do the exact same thing that I did when people first told me what to do to stay sober. I go to meetings, I call my sponsor, try to work the steps to the best of my ability. Prayer and meditation has become a daily part of my life. I share with women, and I'll tell you another thing, to my knowledge, I don't have any secrets. You know, I came in with a bunch of secrets. I don't want to talk about that stuff and what I did and who I did it with. You know, and I don't have anything. So there's nothing that I wouldn't share with another woman today one-on-one. And I feel like that gives me a lot of freedom and a lot of gratitude. So thank you all for listening.